Hello and welcome to Ox Talk on Tuesday the 10th of June 2025. My name's Simon and I'll be compiling this week's edition, in which you will hear a selection of news items from the local Oxford papers, chosen and read by Leslie Court and Bridget Toole. We shall also hear an excerpt from Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, read by David Brassington. Copying and distribution of the USBs is by Michelle Lawful. Before we start, here is some information on how to listen to Oxtalk on your Alexa device. At the end of the news, you can hear information on how to access Oxtalk online.
Notice to listeners of Oxtalk who use a smart speaker to access our service. There are new instructions for anyone who listens to Oxtalk using Alexa. To listen to Oxtalk in this way, you now have to use the Talking Newspaper skill. First, you need to enable it. Simply say, Alexa, enable Talking Newspaper. Then, to listen to Oxtalk, please follow this procedure. Alexa, open Talking Newspaper.
Welcome to your Talking Newspaper skill. Please say the name of a newspaper or a town or city you would like to hear from.
Oxford.
Here are the following newspapers nearest to Oxford. Please pick a newspaper name. Oxford and District Talking News, Whitney Talking News Latest Edition, Whitney Talking News Previous Edition, Whitney Talking Magazine, Wallingford, and District Talking Newspaper. Or do you want to hear more?
Oxford and District Talking News.
Do you want to listen to Oxford and District Talking News?
Yes.
This is Oxford and District Talking News.
If you have problems listening to Oxtalk in this way, it could be due to the way that your Alexa device is set up. Please check the settings with whoever set up your device in the first place. If you still have problems, please contact Oxtalk and we will try to help.
A new website has been launched to help anyone who lives in, works in, or visits Oxford to find alternatives to travelling around the city by car. Oxford Travel Options is designed to support residents, commuters, visitors, and businesses by offering up-to-date information on sustainable travel options. It was developed by the Zero Carbon Oxfordshire Partnership, a group of Oxfordshire's leading institutions and employers working together to achieve zero carbon emissions, and climate charity Low Carbon Oxford North, with support from social enterprise Low Carbon Hub. Jerry Woods, champion of Zero Carbon Oxfordshire Partnership's Sustainable Travel Working Group, said, "Transport is one of Oxford's biggest sources of carbon emissions, and we know that helping people shift how they travel, even in small ways, is key to tackling this. The website brings together local travel advice to help people choose low-carbon options that fit their daily lives, including guidance for employers, supporting staff to travel more sustainably. We hope it will be a useful tool for employers, residents and visitors alike to make more confident, informed choices about how they travel."
Oxford Bus Group have welcomed Oxfordshire County Council's announcement that it would develop plans to tackle congestion and say that the city's traffic is having a devastating impact. The County Council have contentious plans to introduce traffic filters on several of the city's roads, with the aim of easing traffic, lowering emissions and delivering faster and more reliable buses. However, the continued closure of Bockley Road means that the trial will not go ahead until after the road reopens in August 2026. At the end of May, the group's managing director, Luke Marion, urged the County Council to find a Plan B to dealing with the city's traffic issues given this delay. The group say that journey times on the Abingdon Road have increased by an average of 17% since the Bockley Road was closed, with services between Blackbird Leas and Oxford City Centre slowing by 33% compared with 2013. The County Council responded to say that they would draft new plans to deal with the city's congestion problem. In response to the announcement, Mr. Marion said, "We are encouraged by this and look forward to engaging with Oxfordshire County Council on solutions to improve journeys for bus users locally. A robust bus network is critical in order for the council to achieve its sustainability targets on the county's roads, which we are wholly supportive of. Already we have invested more than £30 million into our electric infrastructure, saving 13 tonnes of harmful CO2 emissions each day. We've used data to enhance priority services by linking passengers to key employment hubs, hospitals and residential areas with greater efficiency and frequency. Backed by the government's bus fare cap and enhanced partnerships with local authorities, our patronage is up and bus travel has been made more accessible. To further enhance the appeal of travelling by bus, we need journeys to be faster and more reliable than is currently possible. Present levels of congestion are having a devastating impact on our city, which we're keen to help resolve through positive discussion. Potential options to travelling conditions will be discussed by the newly elected County Cabinet."
A car crash on a residential road in Oxford has fuelled urgent calls for speed cameras, with locals calling it a disaster waiting to happen zone. Two drivers were hospitalised after a white BMW drove into the back of a black taxi on Morrill Avenue near Headington Hill on Thursday evening, 29th of May. Images show the front of the BMW and rear of the taxi were completely smashed. Police and ambulance services appeared at the scene and the two drivers were taken to hospital, but no one was seriously injured. Morrill Avenue Area Residents Association, that's MARA, have been campaigning for speed cameras and a bus gate on the road since the low traffic neighbourhoods were introduced in 2022. The road has a 20 mile an hour speed limit, but the group say they have recorded speeds of up to 95 miles an hour. The day before the crash, County Councillor Emma Garnett and City Councillor Alex Powell met with the group to discuss ways of tackling dangerous driving. Ms. Garnett, who represents the Parks Division and was at the scene yesterday, said, "Residents have been sounding the alarm on this for a while. We absolutely need speed cameras on Morrill Avenue before something dangerous happens. If there had been cyclists or pedestrians on the pavement, they would have been crushed between the car and the wall, and that would have been catastrophic. I think we need to be reframing speeding not as a minor traffic violation, but as a dangerous and extremely violent crime. There are far too many fatalities and serious injuries on Oxfordshire roads. We are really keen to install speed cameras, but the only one that can do that is Thames Valley Police. Enforcing speed limits, particularly the 20 mile an hour speed limits, and setting up speed cameras in dangerous hotspots would be one of the most effective things that Thames Valley Police could do to reduce death, violent crime and tragedy in our county. This needs to be a priority." Erin Buchanan, chairman of the MARA, who also visited the crash site, said, "It is indeed ironic that only the day before we were meeting with our green councillors to reiterate the problems of speeding and high traffic numbers on Morrill Avenue. Enforcement of 20 mile an hour speed limits is vital to making them work, because when observed, they really do work to make our streets safer. Despite being a fully residential street, being plagued by some drivers regularly exceeding 50 miles an hour, including speeds of up to 95 miles an hour, means that until speed cameras and a bus gate are installed, it remains a disaster waiting to happen zone."
Lock keepers on the River Thames in Oxfordshire will join workers in a strike against the Environment Agency over safety concerns in the job. GMB Union has said more than 90% voted to walk out over budget-driven decisions that are putting people and property at risk, as lock keepers on the waterway report issues with a lack of staff and funding. There are only 52 permanent trained staff on the River Thames, with 10 planned agency posts, which expire at the end of this year, yet to be filled. According to the Environment Agency assessment from 2008, more than 90 staff members were needed there during the peak season. Kevin Brandstatter, GMB National Officer, said, "Our River Thames weir and lock keepers are passionate, dedicated workers. They live and work with river users and don't want to go on strike. But there are only 52 staff doing the work of 90. It's just not safe. They've gone above and beyond, backwards, to keep people safe, but enough is enough. They have the support of boaters, river users, those who live on and by the river, and hikers. And they now feel withdrawing their labour is the only way to get their message across to the Environment Agency. Strikes have now been promised by the union, with a final opportunity for the agency to come up with an offer that union members will accept, which has been set for the next week or so." An Environment Agency spokesman said, "It is disappointing that our lock keepers have chosen to strike. We have been working with the lock keepers over the last few months to try and avoid such action being taken. To be clear, we have not proposed any cuts to jobs or services and are committed to continually working and listening to them to modernise the service we offer. We will continue to ensure our locks and weirs will function over any strike period." Lock keepers on the Thames not only assist boaters to navigate the waterways, locks and weirs, but also play a vital role in maintaining safe river levels. This becomes essential at the peak of summer and winter seasons to protect wildlife, land and surrounding homes from the dangers of droughts and floods. The dates for the strike action have yet to be announced, but employers will have 2 weeks' notice of their start and end date before they commence. A petition on the issue has been circulated by Oxfordshire Lock Keepers, which states that falling staff numbers has resulted in property flooding, damage to vessels and wildlife, and animal mortality, which will only get worse with climate change. They say the job is unique and necessary to protect public safety, adding, "Every year, lock keepers save lives and prevent countless injuries, but their concerns of public safety have been ignored by the Environment Agency in favour of perceived cost-cutting."
Oxfordshire County Council has made more than £5 million from penalty charge notices, that's PCNs, since 2022, new figures have revealed. The research conducted by car insurance company Confused.com shows Oxfordshire County Council has made £5,370,730 from PCNs issued to motorists found to be in contravention of parking restrictions over the last 3 years. The figures also state that 185 councils out of the 422 in the UK have issued more than 16 million PCNs since 2022, generating more than £600 million in revenue. Out of the 185 councils included in the data, Oxfordshire County Council was ranked in the top 10, falling below Portsmouth City Council, which has made over £5.7 million. In response to the data, Councillor Andrew Gant, Oxfordshire County Council's Cabinet Member for Transport Management, thanked civil enforcement officers for the difficult job they do. "Bad parking is illegal, dangerous and antisocial," he said. "That's why we work with our civil enforcement officers to try to stop it. They do a difficult job on behalf of all Oxfordshire residents and I thank them for it. I get requests all the time for more enforcement from fellow councillors, members of the public, bus operators, emergency services and others, all of whom see the damage and inconvenience caused by drivers choosing to park on pavements, on tight corners, in bus lanes, and on crossings designed for wheelchair users and parents with pushchairs. We are looking hard at all aspects of the powers available to us, some of which will require action from central government. These include joining calls for government to give us powers to enforce pavement parking, as is already the case in London and Scotland, but not, bizarrely, elsewhere. I would be delighted if civil enforcement generated no income at all. While it does, those funds in the first place make the enforcement regime self-supporting. If there is a surplus, it must by law be repurposed into supporting transport policy more widely. Ridian Jones, car insurance expert at Confused.com, said, "Just like many of our motoring bills, the cost of PCNs is an extra strain on the pockets of drivers. If you're unsure whether you can park in a space or not, don't take the risk. You should consider parking elsewhere to avoid the risk of getting a fine, even if it's only for a few minutes. And if you do receive a PCN fine, you might be able to challenge the decision if you think it was unfair. The process may vary depending on your local authority, so it's important to check this before doing so."
Areas surrounding Oxford, such as Kidlington and Botley, could be brought within Oxford's boundaries under proposals which would expand onto greenbelt land, including the so-called Kidlington Gap, which has proved divisive amongst locals. The government's plans to simplify local councils and abolish two-tier authorities means that Oxfordshire could be split into one, two, or three unitary councils. Unitary councils control all council services, including transport, planning, housing, and social care, rather than splitting them between a county council and district councils. Oxford City Council is pushing for the three council option, which would include a Greater Oxford Council covering the city and its greenbelt. The authority has published a map of what this council could look like, which shows that surrounding villages, including Kidlington, Kennington, Botley, Berinsfield, and Wheatley, would come under Greater Oxford Council. The City Council say this would allow more than 40,000 new homes to be built within Greater Oxford by 2040. It added that this could create up to 29,100 new jobs by building more research, development, and commercial spaces, which would generate up to £2 billion a year for the UK economy. The proposal would also give Oxford residents control of its greenbelt, which was created in 1975 for the first time, as it lies outside of the city's boundaries at the moment. Leader of Oxford City Council, Susan Brown, said that splitting services between multiple councils in Oxfordshire was confusing for residents, and that it means decisions affecting the Greater Oxford area can be made by councillors from Chipping Norton or Henley. She added, "Greater Oxford will bring local decisions under one roof and closer to the public they affect, helping us build more affordable homes, provide new bus connections, protect green spaces, and enhance biodiversity and create new secure jobs for our children and grandchildren. Our proposals will bring better services and help make Greater Oxford a fairer place to live, work, and visit." Under the City Council's proposals, there would be a Northern Oxfordshire Council, covering most of the existing Charwell and West Oxfordshire districts, and Ridgeway Council, covering most of the existing South Oxfordshire and Vale of Wight Horse districts, combined with the West Berkshire Unitary. Greater Oxford would cover a region with a population of about 240,000 people today, which the City Council say would rise to about 345,000 by 2040. The Council also estimates that Northern Oxfordshire would have 265,000 people today and is expected to have 340,000 in 2040, while Ridgeway Council would have 430,000 residents today and is expected to have 545,000 by 2040.
Campaigners fighting plans for a mega reservoir near Abingdon have dismissed government claims Britain will face water shortages. Water Minister Emma Hardy warned that the country will face water rationing like we have in the Mediterranean without new reservoirs. It comes as controversial plans to start on massive infrastructure projects near Abingdon are pushed ahead by Labour, with the South East Strategic Reservoir southwest of the town expected to be nearly as big as Gatwick Airport, holding 150 billion litres of water. The minister suggested that water shortages could hit households and businesses in the next decade if the government fails to build new artificial lakes, as she unveiled plans to speed up the planning approvals process. The government plans to bring in legislation that makes reservoir proposals nationally significant in terms of planning, giving ministers rather than local councils the final say on whether projects go ahead. At the same time, Environment Secretary Steve Reed intervened to bring two projects planned in Cambridgeshire and Lincolnshire into the nationally significant category. But campaigners against the Abingdon project said the changes were for nothing. Derek Stork, spokesperson for the Group Against Reservoir Development, or GARD, said, "This statement is just the government trying to look as though it is taking action, when really it's not taking action at all." These reservoirs, as is the case with the South East Strategic Reservoir proposal, were already nationally significant projects, so won't be sped up. Mr. Stork said that the government already took control of the Abingdon Reservoir project by approving the development consent order to allow the £2.7 million project to go ahead without a public inquiry. GARD, along with organisations Safer Waters and CPRE Oxfordshire, will be appealing this decision at a High Court judicial review hearing scheduled for 2 days starting June the 26th. Mr. Stork said, "We started off opposing this reservoir, but what we've got round to is the system is just totally not fit for purpose. That's why we're taking the government to court. This reservoir is only symptomatic of what's wrong with the system."
Thames Water has said that the US private equity giant KKR has pulled out of plans to invest in the utility, and it is now progressing talks with senior creditors for an alternative to stabilise its finances. The heavily indebted supplier, Britain's biggest water supplier with 16 million customers, said the investment firm indicated it would not be in a position to proceed with a bid and that its status as preferred bidder had lapsed. Thames Water said it intends to take forward discussions with certain senior creditors on an alternative plan to recapitalise the business. It will also hold talks with regulator Ofwat on the senior creditors' plan. Sir Adrian Montague, chairman of Thames Water, said, "Whilst the news is disappointing, we continue to believe that a sustainable recapitalisation of the company is in the best interest of all stakeholders and continue to work with our creditors and stakeholders to achieve that goal. The company will therefore progress discussions on the senior creditors' plan with Ofwat and other stakeholders. The board would like to thank the senior creditors for their continuing support." KKR was chosen as preferred bidder at the end of March to invest more than £3 billion of new equity into Thames Water to help keep it operating amid fears that the supplier was running out of cash. Thames Water said at the time it would also continue talks with senior creditors on a parallel alternative transaction, given there was no certainty over a deal being finalised with KKR. But the withdrawal of KKR now raises the spectre of a temporary government nationalisation once more, should it fail to secure a rescue deal. Thames Water is about £19 billion in debt, and MPs were told last month that at one point this year, it had about 5 weeks' worth of cash left before going bust. Environment Secretary Steve Reed said the government was keeping a very close eye on the situation at Thames Water. Mr. Reed told LBC Radio that Thames itself remains stable, but added, "The government is clearly keeping a very close eye on it. We're monitoring the situation, but there's no disruption to water supply. Thames have got a number of options that they're exploring." He said that, as things stand, Thames Water is a stable, ongoing company, but the government was ready for any eventuality. If the circumstances happened with any company, any water company, where there was a breach and it would need to be put into special administration, that would happen. but as things stand, that's not applying to any company right now.
Oxford residents were shocked after Thames Water gave them bottled water while it worked to fix a mains leak near the railway station. Several people living on Roger Dubman Way and Venet Close were surprised on Sunday, June the 1st, to discover that their water pressure was low. Later on, they and others were further startled when a representative of Thames Water turned up with bottles of water for use in case the mains supply stopped working completely. John Howson, who has lived in the area for 8 years, was one of the people visited by the UK's largest water company and said, "Residents were originally alerted on Sunday morning via the Venet Close community Facebook page where someone asked about low water pressure. Then I got a knock on my door and someone gave me bottled water, but they didn't tell me why." Mr. Howson made clear that the leak that caused the repair works had only a limited impact, affecting mainly the upper floors of his building. However, he was critical about how the situation was communicated. Thames Water's response was a bit haphazard, he said. A van turned up with bottles of water with a list of flats to deliver them to, but there was no accompanying paper saying what it was about. So if you'd been out at the time, you wouldn't have known what was going on. You would have thought there'd be leaflets for this. They were quite rightly taking precautions, but were doing it in such a haphazard way, without communication. Thames Water has since clarified that it fixed a leak on a private water main near the west side of Station Bridge, and that the repairs ended at around midnight. A Thames Water spokesperson said, "On Sunday the 1st of June, we repaired a leak on a private water main which was affecting the water supply of residents in the Abbey Road area, west of Station Bridge. We completed the repair on behalf of the private supply owners, which involved shutting off the supply, and we handed out bottled water to affected residents while we fixed the pipe." Though asked by the Oxford Mail, Thames Water did not reveal the cause of the leak, something that Mr. Howson, who is a part-time education consultant, would be keen to know more about. He added that residents in the local area are particularly sensitive to structural issues at the moment as they continue to deal with the impact of the Botley Railway Bridge closure. He said it's inconvenient for everybody in Botley, but it's doubly inconvenient for us who have to walk there to get anywhere. Americans are flocking to the Cotswolds as property prices plunge, dubbing it the Hamptons of England. Buying homes here can be around 40% cheaper than over the Atlantic Ocean, according to the Daily Mail. The Cotswolds is home to 91,000 people, is within six counties, including Oxfordshire, and is governed from Gloucestershire. Thanks to the cheaper prices and outstanding beauty, more and more Americans are choosing to make the move. It's terribly beautiful. The scenery is glorious, store owner and Boston native Jesse D'Ambrosi, who moved 5 years ago, told Mail Online. The Cotswolds is the Hamptons of England, without the sea, of course. It's also comparable to going upstate, though it's a bit more rural and bucolic. However, Londoners are being priced out of properties in the Cotswolds, according to new figures. Residents from the UK capital accounted for just 9% of those looking to purchase a home in the Cotswolds last year. This research by Hamptons shows a decline from a peak of 14% back in 2021, showing the exodus from London to have shrunk in recent years. The Telegraph argues this is because they are being priced out, with average house prices in the Cotswolds rising 56% since 2014. This is twice the growth recorded in London over the last decade, which stands at 28%. Londoners haven't had the housing market on their side for the best part of a decade, said David Fell of Hamptons. This notion of exclusivity has been bolstered by the presence of several private member clubs in the area. Cotswolds council leader Joe Harris added that US nationals are all over the Cotswolds. A warning has been issued after tourists' drone cameras breached the privacy of villagers in the Cotswolds. The picturesque area attracts thousands of visitors throughout the year due to its idyllic waterways, golden stone houses and abundance of jaw-dropping nature scenes. Yet these chocolate box towns and villages, which are a honeypot to tourists, are also bringing in an unwanted problem with the crowd. Locations in Oxfordshire and Wiltshire, such as the prettiest village in England, Castle Combe, are now under threat from camera drones. According to a recent article in The Times, residents have had their privacy breached by tourists operating the flying cameras. The report said, in recent weeks, some overexcited, impertinent, or else plain sinister visitors have seen fit to buzz children playing in their back garden, film teenage girls sunbathing in their bikinis at home, stalk the chairman of the parish council along the high street 5 feet above his head, and even hover outside one chap's bathroom as he soaked in the tub. There are rules in place which prohibit aircraft from within 150 metres of residential areas if it weighs in excess of 250 grams. But most drones weigh under this and are allowed to fly over homes, as has been occurring in the Cotswolds.
Builders merchant Blanchford Building Supplies racked up debts of more than £3.3 million to suppliers before it fell into administration. The 75-year-old Headington-based business closed down without warning earlier this year, without giving any reason. All four of Blanchford's shops in Bicester, Wallingford, Prince's Risborough and Haddenham closed on February the 14th. Timothy Townley and Danny Dartnail of business restructuring specialist BBQ LLP were appointed as joint administrators in mid-February. In their report, the administrators have said that Blanchford traded profitably over the year, but had been loss-making since 2017, with the exception of 2021 and 2022. Accounts show turnover had reduced by around 3 million, that's 21%, in 2024 compared to 2023. Mr. Townley said in his report, "The company continued to underperform, and its cash position deteriorated further, leaving it unable to purchase essential stock lines such as sand and cement. Consequently, management concluded that without significant additional investment from the existing shareholders or new owner or investor of around £1 million, a cessation of trade and a formal insolvency process would be inevitable. A sale process for the business was launched on January the 30th with a deadline of February the 7th, but this was not enough time for interested parties," Mr. Townley said. "And consequently, with Blanchford facing an increased threat of creditor action and no way of paying staff for February, management concluded insolvency was inevitable," he added. One of the first actions the administrators took was to make 56 employees redundant, but keep a handful on to help wind down the business. On the date of the administrator's appointment, Blanchford had 28,068 pounds cash in the bank, which was frozen, as well as 6,062 pounds in petty cash. More than 260 creditors are estimated to be owed more than £3.3 million, with the administrator receiving so far claims of just over £900,000. Current forecast suggests creditors will receive 2.7 pence in the pound back. Many businesses are Oxfordshire based, including aggregate supplier Smith & Sons, which is owed £37,000, Abingdon based commercial vehicle specialist M&M Commercials, owed £22,000, and WEI and MTMF Mallins of Lord's Farm Bicester owed £148,000. HMRC, a secondary creditor, has put in a claim for around £239,000 for unpaid VAT and PAYE. A total of 59 employees, current and former, have put in claims totalling over £620,000. The book value of Blanchford stock is at £3.3 million, with an estimate to realise value of £161,000 plus, significantly lower because many are not working properly or are broken. Administrators have estimated that around £490,000 can be brought back from the sale of vehicles and returning hire vehicles.
Preparations are now underway for a new M&S food hall in Abingdon. The High Street giant confirmed last month it will be opening the new outlet on the site of the former Homebase store at Fairacres Retail Park. New artwork showing shoppers has now been placed in the windows, although it does not feature the M&S logo. The Homebase store shut in February after the company went into administration, leaving the warehouse-style store empty. Now the popular fashion, beauty, homeware and food retailer has announced it will be moving in, and the new store could open before the end of the year. The retail site spans more than 18,000 square feet, and the move comes as part of M&S's rotation and renewal programme. It will include the opening of 12 new food stores in total, which the company claims will create 550 new jobs, with 8 of them to be completed by summer 2026. Last year, M&S opened 6 food stores and 2 full-line stores and renewed 9 existing stores. In a strong year for the company, food sales outperformed target by approximately 20%. Features of the renewed stores include larger car parks, brighter entrances, the introduction of coffee bakeries, more spacious aisles, and expanded frozen sections. The new M&S store is next door to a Costa Coffee and Lidl supermarket. The Homebase store opened in 2021 alongside the Lidl and Costa Coffee, but it was not included in a rescue deal from The Range.
Oxfam workers have said they cannot allow their employer to make redundancies and outsource staff. Oxfam is believed to be planning to replace up to 250 jobs and replace them with casual workers, the union Unite has said. A protest of around 20 workers took place at the Oxford office in John Smith Road on Tuesday afternoon, June the 3rd. One protester, Maureen Thompson, said she will be affected by the possible redundancies, but given how she is now at retirement age, she's fighting more for her colleagues. The 71-year-old said, "For me, I'm at retirement age, so I'm happy to be here if it would save somebody else's job. There are a lot of people who don't have a stable job right now, and it's just not right. We have to protect the jobs now, because otherwise what happens in the future if it's not? If they get away with doing it now, they'll just keep on doing it. We've been having meetings, but it's been hard getting information and everything from Oxfam. Generally, we try to have a good relationship because we believe that is going to be better." Shop steward Amit Srivastava said, "Outsourcing is clearly a mistake," while calling on Oxfam to rethink plans. He said, "We are surprised that Oxfam said it's not preparing to outsource work, because it has told workers in writing that it is. In fact, its own proposal cites its intention to outsource no less than 4 times. Oxfam has said it will seek to outsource our publishing and shift towards outsourcing elements of training." He added, "This protest is part of a wider campaign as we try to save hundreds of jobs now under threat at Oxfam. We will be putting more proposals to Oxfam in the coming weeks to save jobs and in particular avoid compulsory redundancies." Merlin Mayer said that although his position isn't affected, he is protesting to make sure as many jobs stay secure and stable within Oxfam. He added, "Our development team will be affected, and these are people that we lean on for our career progression. Oxfam has specifically said it will be outsourcing, and we are directly against it." Although not confirmed by the charity, Unite claims the outsourcing will target workers in the publishing and training teams. A spokesman from Oxfam previously said, "These restructuring proposals are to secure our financial future, not about a policy to replace in-house roles with non-unionised casual labour. Where our capacity is reduced, if we use short-term specialist expertise, it will be in accordance with our labour rights standards and our values."
He was plainly blind, for he tapped before him with a stick, and wore a great green shade over his eyes and nose, and he was hunched, as if with age or weakness, and wore a huge old tattered sea cloak with a hood that made him appear positively deformed. I never saw in my life a more dreadful-looking figure. He stopped a little from the inn, and, raising his voice in an odd sing-song, addressed the air in front of him.
"Will any kind friend inform a poor blind man who has lost the precious sight of his eyes in the gracious defence of his native country, England, and God bless King George, where or in what part of this country he may now be?"
"You are at the Admiral Benbow, Black Hill Cove, my good man," said I.
"I hear a voice," said he, "a young voice. Will you give me your hand, my kind young friend, and lead me in?"
I held out my hand, and the horrible, soft-spoken, eyeless creature gripped it in a moment like a vice. I was so much startled that I struggled to withdraw, but the blind man pulled me close up to him with a single action of his arm.
"Now, boy," he said, "take me to the captain."
"Sir," said I, "upon my word, I dare not."
"Oh," he sneered, "that's it. Take me in straight or I'll break your arm."
And he gave it, as he spoke, a wrench that made me cry out.
"Sir," said I, "it is for yourself I mean. The captain is not what he used to be. He sits with a drawn cutlass. Another gentleman..."
"Come now, march,"
interrupted he, and I never heard such a voice so cruel and cold and ugly as that blind man's. It cowed me more than the pain, and I began to obey him at once, walking straight in at the door and towards the parlour, where our sick old buccaneer was sitting, dazed with rum. The blind man clung close to me, holding me in one iron fist, and leaning almost more of his weight on me than I could carry.
"Lead me straight up to him, and when I'm in view, cry out, 'Here's a friend for you, Bill. If you don't, I'll do this.'"
And with that, he gave me a twitch that I thought would have me faint. Between this and that, I was so utterly terrified of the blind beggar that I forgot my terror of the captain, and as I opened the parlour door, cried out the words he had ordered in a trembling voice. The poor captain raised his eyes, and at one look the rum went out of him and left him staring sober. The expression of his face was not so much of terror as of mortal sickness. He made a movement to rise, but I do not believe he had enough force left in his body.
"Now, Bill, sit where you are," said the beggar. "If I can't see, I can hear a finger stirring. Business is business. Hold out your right hand. Boy, take his right hand by the wrist and bring it near to my right."
We both obeyed him to the letter, and I saw him pass something from the hollow of the hand that held his stick into the palm of the captain's, which closed upon it instantly.
"And now that's done," said the blind man,
and at the words he suddenly left hold of me, and, with incredible accuracy and nimbleness, skipped out of the parlour and into the road, where, as I still stood motionless, I could hear his stick go tap, tap, tapping into the distance. It was some time before either I or the captain seemed to gather our senses, but at length, and about at the same moment, I released his wrist, which I was still holding, and he drew in his hand and looked sharply into the palm.
10 o'clock, he cried. 6 hours, we'll do them yet.
And he sprang to his feet. Even as he did so, he reeled, put his hand to his throat, stood swaying for a moment, and then, with a peculiar sound, fell from his whole height, face foremost, to the floor. I ran to him at once, calling to my mother. But haste was all in vain. The captain had been struck dead by thundering apoplexy.
The founder of Morris Motors is satirised as a soulless industrialist in a story by J.R.R. Tolkien that is to be published for the first time. William Morris, Viscount Nuffield, is thought to have inspired the Lord of the Rings author to create a villain for a satirical fantasy in which he vented his loathing for the motor car and its devastating impact on Oxford. Mr. Morris made his fortune by mass-producing small cars at affordable prices and donated millions to worthy causes. Morris Motors became the major employer in the region during Tolkien's lifetime, providing a pull for workers and businesses supporting the car industry. A dramatic rise in Oxford's population between the wars was driven partly by the growth of the industry. The businessman is thought to be the inspiration for a character known as the Daemon of Vachipratum in the never-before-published story The Bovardium Fragments, according to the Telegraph. It is thought Mr. Tolkien also took inspiration from a planning controversy that erupted in the 1940s when he was Oxford University's Professor of English Language and Literature at Merton College. A bid to alleviate traffic by building a dual carriageway across Christchurch Meadow, an ancient open space in the heart of Oxford, sparked a lengthy public debate well into the 1960s when the plan was eventually abandoned. The Bovardium Fragments reflects Mr. Tolkien's mastery of Latin. Bovardium was the Latinised name for the village of Oxford, and the Daemon of Vachipratum translates as the Demon of the Cow Pasture, or Cowley, where Mr. Morris had established his motor manufacturing plant. In one passage of the story, Mr. Tolkien writes, "But it came to pass that a daemon, as popular opinion supposed, in his secret workshops devised certain abominable machines to which he gave the name Motores." The Bovardium Fragments was among Tolkien manuscripts either donated or deposited posthumously by his estate to Oxford's Bodleian Library. It will be published in October by HarperCollins. Chris Smith, the HarperCollins publishing director, described it as a sharply satirical account of the perils of allowing car production and machine worship to take over your town, where things ultimately all go to hell, in a very literal sense. Mr. Tolkien's son and literary executor, Christopher, had edited the text before his death in 2020. The book will include an essay by Richard Ovenden, Bodley's librarian, who has conducted extensive research into the planning controversy, having established its inspiration for Mr. Tolkien's story. Mr. Tolkien is most famous for writing fantasy tales, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. He died in 1973. Mr. Morris, Lord Nuffield, is remembered as the founder of the Nuffield Foundation, the Nuffield Trust, and Oxford University's Nuffield College. He died in 1963.
People with dyslexia could benefit from a new lamp created by a university student from Wantage. The device, called Focus Glow, was designed by 22-year-old Amy Simcock, a product design student at Nottingham Trent University. It aims to help people with conditions that affect perceptual processing with reading by emitting different coloured lights. Ms. Simcock was inspired by her own experiences with Myers-Erlend syndrome, also known as visual stress, a condition similar to dyslexia that can make words appear jumbled on a page. She said, "I knew something was wrong when I was at secondary school and asked my friends if they were experiencing the same, but they weren't. It's almost like you're looking at a page and everything is jumbled around and moving. But as soon as you put a blue layer over the page, it calms down and removes all of the noise." She discovered blue light made reading easier, but found existing products such as overlays to be impractical and tinted glasses to trigger migraines. Focus Glow was created as an alternative, offering multiple colour options to suit different users. The lamp stands above a desk on stained hardwood legs, leaving space for reading, writing, or drawing. It uses 12-volt RGBW LED batteries and features a rotator switch for selecting one of seven colours: red, blue, green, yellow, white, pink, or orange. A second dial allows users to adjust the angle and direction of the lamp, or turn the lamp away to use it as a mood lamp. The casing is made from steel and acrylic tubing with 3D printed dials. Ms. Simcock said, According to the British Dyslexia Association, an estimated 10% of the population have dyslexia. So it's amazing that there aren't more products around to support such a large amount of people. And that doesn't even take into account the number of people who have visual stress and any other conditions that could benefit from this. So a light seemed the best answer, not least because it has the potential to be adjustable to suit a wide variety of people. Her design will go on public display as part of the 2025 Nottingham Trent University Student Showcase, one of the UK's largest exhibitions of graduating art and design talent. Max Pownall, principal lecturer in BA Product Design at Nottingham Trent University, said, "Amy has taken her personal experience of visual stress and demonstrated how there's a huge gap in the market for a product like this, which could benefit millions of people who have dyslexia and other similar conditions."
Sir Alex Ferguson has been announced as an ambassador of a Kidlington charity set up by three-time Formula One world champion Sir Jackie Stewart. The former Manchester United manager has taken on the role at Race Against Dementia, founded by Sir Jackie in 2016 after his wife, Helen, was diagnosed with frontotemporal dementia. Sir Alex, the most successful manager in British football history, said, "What Race Against Dementia is doing is so inspiring. Dementia is a fight we cannot afford to lose, and I am proud to be supporting the charity in my role as ambassador. The charity funds and trains researchers aiming to prevent dementia and ultimately find a cure. Sir Alex has seen the effects of dementia firsthand and has long advocated for greater support for former footballers affected by the condition." Mark Stewart, chairman of Race Against Dementia and Sir Jackie's son, said, "We are proud to welcome Sir Alex as a Race Against Dementia ambassador. He is one of the greatest problem solvers of our time, an inspiring leader who has always pursued excellence." Race Against Dementia has also announced a new partnership with DHL, the official logistics partner of Formula One, to offer fans the chance to win two grandstand passes for the 2025 Silverstone Grand Prix weekend.
An MP has joined the fight to save a successful and well-used post office in an Oxfordshire village and to demand justice for a former sub-postmaster who was wrongfully convicted during the Horizon scandal. The community set up a campaign to save the Outreach post office in Horsepath shortly before it closed on March the 28th. This came after the resignation of the postmistress for Great Milton, who provided an outreach service at the Horsepath Community Hub for 3 hours on a Friday morning. Locals raised concerns about accessing their nearest post office, which is 3 miles away in Wheatley, due to the lack of public transport links which many older residents rely on. Freddie Manmiolo, Liberal Democrat MP for Henley and Tame, visited the Horsepath Community Hub along with local councillor Tim Bearder on May the 30th to speak to supporters and sign the petition. Mr. Manmiolo said, "The closure of the Outreach post office is a devastating blow to Horsepath, a village where many elderly and vulnerable residents rely on this essential service. This is not a failing service. It's a successful and well-used facility embedded in the heart of the community. The post office's decision to close it without meaningful engagement is completely unacceptable." The MP is writing to the chairman of the post office and the Minister for Postal Affairs, urging them to intervene, and will help the community take their petition to the door of number 10. He also called on the post office to reinstate the Horsepath service, which would potentially come under stewardship of the Wheatley postmaster. "The infrastructure is in place. The community wants it, and a new postmaster is ready to step in. There is no excuse for delay. The post office must do the right thing and bring this vital service back to a community already so severely damaged by its unthinking actions of the past." Councillor King Bearder, who represents Wheatley on the County Council, said, it's great that we now have a local MP who is active in the community and prepared to champion causes like this on behalf of Horsepath's residents. Tremendous work has already been done by the community to raise the alarm, and now Freddie and I will bring their concerns to the doors of those in power. Following the visit, the MP and councillor also met former Horsepath postmaster Bipin Chandra Patel, whose conviction in the Horizon Post Office scandal was quashed back in December 2020. The family told the MP they had to sell family heirlooms and borrow money from family to stay afloat during the ongoing wait for compensation. The post office branch in Oxford City Centre will not be closing, but will be operated by a retail franchise. Post office chairman Nigel Railton announced that 115 directly owned branches would close last November, with the St Aldate's branch included on the list. Councillors raised fears about how the closure would affect people who need to access the vital service. A petition to save the post office, which was set up by Councillor Susanna Pressel, garnered almost 2,000 signatures. But last week it was announced that instead of closing, the St Aldate's branch will be run by an independent franchise retail partner, Universal Office Equipment, at the same premises. The same range of services will be available, and the opening hours will remain largely the same, except that the branch will open at 9 a.m. on Tuesdays instead of 9:30. The post office will not offer the opportunity for feedback on the change, but has opened a consultation on the opening hours. Reacting to the update, Ms. Pressel said, "It seems we are not losing our central post office, which is good. But who knows what the new service will be like? Since the present service leaves a lot to be desired, perhaps it will actually be an improvement. Let's hope it is not wholly focused on making a profit for its shareholders." She added that she hoped people would respond to the consultation. Oxford City Council Deputy Leader Anna Railton said, "It was fantastic that it's remaining open for residents of South Oxford and the rest of the city in its original historic building." She added, "I trust all the staff will be retained on the same terms and conditions, and the same or better level of service is provided for customers." The decision to close branches came as the company looked to increase postmaster pay by £250 million over 5 years. Postmasters would also have a greater say in the running of the company as it looks to move on from the Horizon IT scandal. The branch in St Aldate's has been running since 1880. The post office said it expects the changes to happen by September, but will provide a further update in the branch on the specific date of the change. Once the change takes place, the post office will liaise with the franchise partner and review whether to stay in the same branch or not, or move. Any move would be unlikely to happen before spring 2026. University Office Equipment currently operates 8 main post office branches, a banking hub, and a number of stationery stores across London and the South.
Oxfordshire's oldest golf club has achieved the highest membership figures in its history as it begins its 152nd season. Oxford Golf Club, located on Hilltop Road in Cowley, has seen a 66% rise in membership over the past 5 years, with more than 750 regular players now taking to its course. This marks the highest number of members in the club's history, with more than 300 new members compared to a decade ago. Steve Greenwood, General Manager at Oxford Golf Club, said, "It's a huge achievement to reach our highest membership figures on record and is something the whole team can be very proud of." The club attributes its recent growth to sustained investment in its facilities, including upgraded greens, a new irrigation system, and a waste-to-water unit that keeps the course open 364 days a year. Mr. Greenwood said, "Equally, delivering a quality course which can be enjoyed in all seasons has unquestionably contributed to the club's success. It's credit to our hard-working ground staff and the team behind the scenes for making this happen at a time when weather patterns are increasingly unpredictable. The board of directors, too, have been instrumental in delivering the tools required to produce a course that we are all very proud of. Mr. Greenwood also highlighted the club's efforts to broaden its appeal. He said, "There is also a greater emphasis on diversifying our operation using the land and facilities we have at our disposal, with enhanced hospitality options, social events and charitable functions for members and guests alike. Bringing our catering operation in-house has also improved the overall attraction of membership, with greater emphasis placed on the quality of our food and service. The club's full 7-day, junior and international membership packages are now at capacity, with only limited availability in restricted 7-day and 5-day categories. The latest figures from England Golf show 722,000 people across the country are members of a golf club. However, CEO Jeremy Tomlinson expects more than 7,000 members to leave this year due to rising costs and an ageing player base. Mr. Greenwood said, "You have to go back to the 1990s to find membership numbers in the same bracket as what the club is achieving today. Even then, our membership base was 100 people fewer. Founded in 1873 as the original club of Oxford University, Oxford Golf Club features an 18-hole course designed by renowned golf architect Harry Colt." Mr. Greenwood added, "We're ambitious, forward-thinking, and won't be restricting our development plans to the course with other major improvements planned in the coming years." An Oxford museum has been voted as a top family attraction in Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire. The Story Museum was given the title of the best place to take your kids in the two counties by readers of the Muddy Stilettos blog. Caroline Jones, the museum's CEO, said, "We're super chuffed to have won our category in this region. It makes it extra special that the Muddy Awards are voted for by their readers, as it means we are supported and valued by real people. Visitors to the museum this half term explored its interactive galleries, which include a snowy Narnia, a whispering wood, and a chamber filled with dragon lore in the current exhibition, Here Be Dragons. The museum is also celebrating 40 years of the Farmyard Tales books by Heather Amory. Visitors can see artwork by illustrator Stephen Cartwright and spot the little yellow duck in a special trail in the Enchanted Library. The City of Stories exhibition, which celebrates Oxford's literary heritage, closed on June the 1st to make way for a new permanent exhibit."
New figures reveal that more than 4,000 illegal vapes have been seized in Oxfordshire over the course of a year, as concerns of the rise of underage vaping continue to grow. Trading Standards, in partnership with Public Health, visited 54 retailers between April 2024 and March 2025. They found illegal vapes in 27 of these stores, including 10 in Oxford, 5 in Banbury, and 4 in Abingdon. This resulted in 4,398 products being seized, according to the figures from Oxfordshire Fire and Rescue Service's annual report. Several stores across the county have had their licences revoked for possessing illegal tobacco and vapes. The Uni Food and Wine Shop on Park End Street in Oxford had its licence revoked after Trading Standards found more than 200 illegal e-cigarettes and non-compliant nicotine pouches last November. The Premier store in Broadway in Didcot also lost its licence after a large quantity of illegal smuggled tobacco was found. Oxfordshire County Council have confirmed that there are 24 active cases relating to the seizure of illegal vapes, which are either in the court process or under investigation. A ban on single-use disposable vapes came into force on Sunday, June the 1st. The ban aims to prevent children and teenagers from taking up vaping and reducing the number of products going to landfill. Matthew Barber, Police and Crime Commissioner for Thames Valley, said, "I welcome the statistics released. which show the seizure of almost 4,400 illegal vapes by trading standards in the last 12 months. It's positive to see that in partnership with public health, trading standards are proactively visiting retailers and removing illegal supplies before they can impact our children's lives. Following the implementation of a UK-wide ban on the use of disposable vapes, it is hoped that alongside the environmental impacts, this will further restrict young people's access to vapes. Thames Valley Police will continue to work with trading standards in efforts to protect our children and young people from accessing illegal vapes and cigarettes. Trading standards also seized 15,780 illegal cigarettes, 3,150 grams of illegal hand-rolling tobacco, and 47,749 grams of illegal waterpipe tobacco in Oxfordshire over the course of the year.
A new book will shine a light on the architecture of Oxford's historic libraries. Oxford Libraries Architecture, which will be published on June the 26th, explores more than 50 of the city's grandest libraries, some dating back to the 13th century. Written by historian Geoffrey Tyack, with photos by architectural photographer Dan Payton, the book provides detailed insights and specially commissioned images. Oxford contains one of the richest and densest concentrations of libraries anywhere in the world. Once exclusive to scholars, these libraries now serve thousands of students and readers. Designed by famed architects like Sir Christopher Wren, Nicholas Hawksmoor, Sir Edwin Lutyens, and Arne Jacobson, they showcase 800 years of architectural evolution. Oxford Libraries Architecture aims to highlight the cultural and architectural heritage of the city's libraries. Mr. Tyack, an Emeritus Fellow of Kellogg College, University of Oxford, and President of the Oxfordshire Architectural and Historical Society, has previously authored The Historic Heart of Oxford. He is a former director of the Stanford University Centre in Oxford, was once a trustee of the Oxford Preservation Trust, and is editor of the Georgian Group Journal.
A member of staff at an Oxford optician's has gone above and beyond to support a local young adult with autism. Robbie Phillips, store manager at Specsavers on Queen Street, has been welcoming 18-year-old Liam Maynard into the store each month to check the fire extinguishers. Mr. Phillips has made Mr. Maynard a staff name badge and presented him with a training certificate to recognise his contribution, ensuring the extinguishers have not reached their expiry dates. Mr. Phillips said, "We love having Liam come into the store and be part of our team. It's a small way that we can help, and it makes a big difference to him. We've had some lovely feedback from his mum, Mari, too, and it's brilliant to know that his visit to the store helps to make his day. It's really important to us that we support our community, and this is one of the ways that we can do that." Mr. Maynard's mum, Mari, added, "Liam gets a huge amount from coming into Specsavers, and I'm really grateful to Robbie for taking the time to help him. Being given responsibility and shown recognition for doing it gives Liam a huge sense of pride. For a business like Specsavers to take the time to help in this way is something I'd encourage more organisations to do. It may seem small, but the impact is significant."
A former professional rugby player from Oxford has said everyone was just in total shock after she nailed her first ever axe throw. Deborah Wills was attending a party at the Homewood Hotel and Spa near Bath, Somerset, when she decided to try axe throwing for the first time. She hit a bullseye on her first attempt and struck the handle of the first axe with her second throw, splitting it in two. Ms. Wills, who is now a gym manager, said, "Everyone was just in total shock. I'm actually short-sighted, so I only heard the sound of the wood splitting and genuinely couldn't believe it. My husband, who caught it on camera, was completely taken aback, and the instructor said he'd never seen it happen before." Each participant was given five axes to throw. Ms. Wills landed four bullseyes out of five and topped the leaderboard for the entire group, with her husband placing second.
15 Morris dancing sides from across the country will take part in an annual festival in an Oxfordshire village later this month. The teams will gather in Kirtlington for the Morris Dancing Festival, a historic event dating back to the 17th century. John Mayo, Secretary of Kirtlington Morris, said, "Kirtlington Lamb Ale traces its origins to the 17th century, and we're proud to see the traditional alive and well in 2025. It's a fantastic annual occasion and a great opportunity for people of all ages to enjoy this traditional form of dance. The festival will begin on Saturday, June the 14th at 10:30 a.m. with dancing on the village green before the teams head to Woodstock in the afternoon."
And that was the last item for this week. Please note there is now a new telephone number for you to ring if you have any comments about this week's Oxtalk edition. Please ring 07 496 062 280 and leave your name and contact details as well as your message. Alternatively, you can email mail@oxtalk.org.uk. This edition and previous editions are available on our website www.oxtalk.org.uk, where you can either listen or download. Thank you very much for listening.